We're going to do start the last section of the day, which is monitoring the respiratory system. It's section number 49506. And I'm just going to have Craig Cornell start talking now, so that way we have more time and don't run out of any more time.
I'm looking around here trying to see if I recognize any face. Were there any people that listened to my monitoring lecture on Saturday in the room? This is going to be about 75% of this lecture is stuff I talked about, so if you don't want to sit through three quarters of it again, don't feel bad if you have to leave. So let's go ahead and there's a lot of material I want to talk about here, and I'd like to get a head start on it. It's kind of a coincidence, but the owner of this dog is in the room here. This is Marcy's dog. And I'm not going to tell you too much about this dog, but there's something unusual about it. And it's a very nice dog, pretty healthy, but there was something unusual about its color that seemed to get people wondering. And by the end of this lecture, I'm hoping you're going to be able to figure out what's wrong with this dog, and we'll see how smart you are. It might surprise you. What my hope is today is that I will give you enough information and enough knowledge that you'll be able to take all these little bits of information that you see in your monitoring of patients and put it together and actually start to see the big picture. All these different kinds of equipment and stuff that you have, they all give you a little piece of the puzzle, but they don't give you the big picture. And I really hope that at the end of the day, you'll be a little bit smarter and you'll be able to make better use of this information. There's been a huge, huge change in the types of monitoring equipment that are available. You know, 10 years ago, it was only people that were in big institutional practices that had things like blood gases or being able to monitor CO2, end-tidal CO2, or oxygen saturation, because it usually involved some big, expensive piece of equipment that needed to be maintained, and it was very expensive to operate, and you needed a lot of volume and be able to make any money using the thing. Nowadays, these things are cheap. They're within the, ability of any practice to buy these things, and they're very useful. The funny thing is, though, the people that sell these things and people like me that are trying to teach about it, people really don't have a good feeling for what these numbers mean. They're numbers, and they don't really mean anything to people. And so that's what I'd like to be able to do today, is to give you some insight into what these numbers are actually telling you. And some of the stuff might surprise you, what you can actually do with the information. Now we got to talk about a little boring stuff here with graphs and things like that. But you really should know some of this, things like partial pressure, oxygen tension, and things like that. When we're at sea level, the total pressure of the atmosphere is equal to 760 millimeters of mercury. When we're talking about the partial pressure, air is about 80% nitrogen and about 20% oxygen. If you multiply 80% times 760, you end up with 593 millimeters of mercury pressure. 20% oxygen, 20% times 760 gives you about 160. And those two numbers added together give you about 760. So the sum of the partial pressures equals the total pressure. So when you measure partial pressure, it's just a way of telling how many molecules of a particular gas are in a sample of gas or in a sample of liquid. How many molecules are in there? The more molecules, the higher the partial pressure will be. Now, we're in Denver, and Denver is not at sea level. And in Denver, the pressure on us is 630 millimeters of mercury pressure. And I took a drive up into Rocky Mountain National Park yesterday, and I was at about 10,000 feet. And when I was up there, the pressure was even lower. Everywhere on the top of the mountain in the national park and at Denver and at sea level, the concentration of oxygen is the same, 78% in all those places. But there are less molecules in Denver than there are at sea level, and even less on top of the mountain. So when you talk about, when you have an oxygen meter reads 21%, that only tells you part of the story. Partial pressure is something you should think about too. When you're at sea level, one of the things that you'd like to know is what's the normal partial pressure of oxygen in arterial blood? And that's a very important thing to know. And there's a very difficult, fancy equation. It's called the alveolar gas equation. And if you use that, it gives you a pretty good idea of what the arterial oxygen concentration should be. But it's not the sort of calculation you can do in your head. And this is a much better one. If you multiply the percentage of oxygen times 5, that tells you what the arterial PaO2 should be. And it works pretty well. It's pretty accurate. So if you're breathing room air, it's about 20% oxygen. 20 times 5 is 100. If you're doing anesthesia, you're probably using 100% oxygen. And 100 times 5 is 500. So if I take an arterial blood gas sample and run it through the machine and I get 100 back at sea level on room air, I know that I'm doing okay. That's what it should be. If I am on 100% oxygen at sea level and I get close to 500, I'm doing okay. If I get an answer back that says 250, then something's wrong. It usually indicates lung disease. So when you are interpreting arterial blood gases, that rule of thumb is very important to do. If you get, you know, especially during anesthesia, what's normal for that patient breathing that concentration? If you have the patient in the recovery phase and maybe you're using a flow by oxygen or something and you have a pretty good idea what percentage of oxygen that is, let's say maybe you think you're only getting 50% oxygen and you run a blood gas, if you think that the concentration of oxygen in that the patient's breathing is 50%, 50 times 5 would be 250. If I got 80 back, that patient's not doing very well. So that's a very useful thing to know. What's normal on a certain percentage of oxygen? Another thing I want to talk to you about is oxygen saturation. What we're talking about with that is you've got hemoglobin in your blood, and that hemoglobin, the job is to combine with oxygen and carry that oxygen into the tissues. Saturation is just simply telling me what percentage of hemoglobin molecules are combined with oxygen. And if it's 50% saturation, that means that half the molecules of hemoglobin are combined with oxygen and half aren't. And you could think of this as a glass that's half full. You know, the glass can hold 8 ounces, and I've poured 4 ounces into it, so that glass is half saturated. If I pour 8 ounces into the 8-ounce glass, it's 100% saturated, right? Now, the analogy that I always use for people, when you guys go to the bar tonight, and you got your mug of beer, and someone's got a big pitcher, they can keep pouring beer into your glass all day, but you can't fill it more than 100%, right? So, you're drunk and you keep pouring beer in your glass and it just flows all over the table. You can't hold any more than 100%. That's a real important concept to keep in mind, the saturation concept, And I'm going to show you why in a minute. So here's a graph, and this is the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve. And these little dots here represent molecules of oxygen. And obviously, the higher the partial pressure, the more molecules of oxygen there are. Down here where the partial pressure is low, there are very few molecules of oxygen. Where the partial pressure of oxygen is very high, there are lots of molecules of oxygen. So the higher that partial pressure number, the more molecules of oxygen there are that are available. So the bigger that big pitcher is that you're going to pour into your glass, okay? This represents the color of hemoglobin. And obviously when it's full of oxygen, that arterial blood is this nice bright red color. And venous blood, the less oxygen in it, the more purple or blue it looks. And that's the way the pulse oximeter works, and I'll talk more about that later. But this line up here is 100% saturated. Usually at about 140 millimeters of mercury partial pressure, your blood is 99% saturated with oxygen. It's almost full. And I can keep pouring oxygen into that molecule, but it won't hold anymore. And that's a very important thing to remember. And this, remember what I said, if you're breathing 100% oxygen, 5 times 100, I could have a partial pressure of 500 in my, even it can even go a little bit higher than that. You know, you'll sometimes see animals that go up to 600 or more in their, the partial pressure of oxygen in their arterial blood. So this graph goes probably out to like there, just flat like that on the top, because that molecule was full right around here, and I can't fill it more than 100% full. This is really, really important to understand the shape of this curve. It goes up like this, and then it just flattens out and stays like that on out there. It means that once you get a partial pressure higher than about 140 millimeters of mercury, your blood really doesn't hold any more oxygen. Now we've got a machine that's available. I bet you almost everybody in this room has one of these. How many people have a pulse oximeter in their practice? Almost everybody. That's something in the last 5 or 10 years gone from no one having it to everybody having it. But a lot of people don't really understand what's going on with this piece of equipment. Well, this is very complicated looking, but just to tell you how this thing works. There are two LEDs in there. One emits infrared, the other emits visible red. And it sends that light through the tissue, and there are sensors on the back of it. And they pick up the amount of light that's going through there. And oxyhemoglobin absorbs light differently than reduced hemoglobin. And you see this with your eye. When you look at arterial blood, it's red, and the venous blood looks blue. It, almost everybody can see that change. Well, this just does it with a machine. It looks at the blood, and it tells how much oxygen is in there. Now, when you think about it, though, if you look at a venous sample or an arterial sample, you've sucked it out of an artery or a vein. This thing's sending light through a tongue or something like that. How does it know what's arterial blood? It tells me what arterial saturation is, but it's going through skin, it's going through venous blood, it's going through bone. How does it know what is arterial blood? Because it does. The number that's on there is the saturation of arterial blood. Well, what it does is it looks for blood that's pulsating. And it can recognize that blood and subtract out the non-pulsatile blood, skin, bone, muscle, all those things that are not pulsating. And whatever is left over that is pulsating has to be arterial blood. And that's how this machine works. So obviously, if you don't have good pulses, this thing's not going to work very well. And this happens all the time. And there's a misconception about why this occurs. Some people say, oh, the pulse oximeter won't work because the tongue's dry. That's a fallacy. If you use an earlobe clip, is your earlobe wet? That's what it's designed for, is to stick on your ear. Do you have a finger probe on your machine? It's designed for a finger. And if they've got a wet finger, I don't know why it's wet, but it's meant to work on dry tissue. What's going on is if you leave that thing in one place for a while, it pinches. And when it pinches, blood doesn't pulsate anymore and it stops working. So you move it to a different place and it does. It probably has nothing to do with it being dry or not. The other problem, if this thing's not working, is the fact that there are lots of things that can cause your tissue to be vasoconstricted and not pulsating. One, if this is the only thing you're using to monitor your patient, and you're doing a really bad job, blood pressure's crap, cardiac output is crap, the pulses are weak, this thing's not going to work because it's not picking up good, strong pulses. If you have cardiac arrhythmias, that could fool this machine. If you're very, very hypothermic and your tissues are really intensely vasoconstricted, it won't work. If your pulse oximeter doesn't work, you really ought to be asking yourself, why is it not working? If it was working before and now it isn't, you really need to ask yourself what's going on. And if that's the only thing you've got to monitor, you're probably not doing a really great job. If you're not measuring blood pressure, if you're not measuring other things, you could be making a really serious mistake. The fact that this doesn't work maybe is a clue that your patient's not doing very well. Another thing that the pulse ox doesn't tell you, remember, it just tells you of all the hemoglobin molecules that are in your blood, what percentage of them are combined with oxygen? What if you don't have a lot of hemoglobin molecules in your blood? That's not very good, but it doesn't affect your saturation. An anemic patient can have the same saturation that a patient with a good hematocrit has. The pulse oximeter doesn't tell you that. But you really should be thinking about what are the effects of anemia. This curve looks very similar to that oxygen saturation curve. And there's a good reason for it. It's based partially on oxygen saturation. What I'm doing here, these numbers along the side represent milliliters of oxygen in 100 milliliters of blood. And it's pretty amazing. If your hematocrit's about 45, every 100 milliliters of blood holds 20 milliliters of oxygen. Now what happens if I cut my hemoglobin, my hematocrit in half, and I'm down here? It only holds 10. Look at an animal that's got a hematocrit of 10. It's got 1/5 or 1/4 the amount of oxygen that a patient with a normal hematocrit is. What do you think happens? Let me show you something else. There is a little bit of oxygen that's dissolved in the plasma. If I take away all the hemoglobin, that line there shows how much oxygen is dissolved in the plasma. That's how much oxygen is not being combined with hemoglobin. Almost all the oxygen in your blood is carried by hemoglobin. And so if you're anemic, if you have low hemoglobin, you don't have any oxygen in your blood. Now, what do you think happens if I give oxygen to a really anemic patient? We're on that flat part of that curve up there. So I go from 99% saturated hemoglobin to 100%. I increase the oxygen content by 1%. Do you think that really makes a big difference on this guy? No, it doesn't. And if I struggle and fight with that patient, put the mask on their face, and they die, are you surprised why that is? The fact that they have 100% saturation on their pulse oximeter, does that tell you why that animal died? No. It's because their oxygen content was so low. If you've got an anemic patient and they're dying because of their anemia, what do you want to do to fix them? You give them blood. And when you do that, you go from an oxygen content down there to one up there. And that makes a huge difference. There is a formula to figure this out. That's called the Hoefner constant. And that tells you how many mils of oxygen you get. If you multiply that number times the saturation as a fraction, so if you're 100% saturated, 100% equals 1, 50% equals 0.5. Multiply that times this number. Does everybody know how to get hemoglobin from hematocrit? You divide the hematocrit by 3, and that's your hemoglobin. This part of the equation down here, that little tiny number, 3 parts out of 1,000, that's how much is dissolved in plasma. Almost nothing. So you if you have a pulse oximeter, you could actually figure that, and you know the hematocrit, you could figure that out. How many mils of oxygen there are in a blood sample. Now let me give you another situation. Let's say you have a patient under anesthesia and they're breathing 100% oxygen. What did I say that the arterial PaO2 should be if you're breathing 100% oxygen? Come on, you know what this is. 500. 5 times 100. So I'm out here somewhere. Let's say that during anesthesia, something's going on with this patient's lungs. Maybe there's alveolar collapse. Maybe some of the alveoli are, you know, collapsing because they're not being expanded very well. Maybe something else bad has happened with the lungs. What's the saturation out here on my pulse oximeter? Come on, you guys know this. Is that glass full out here? What's the saturation at 200? It's about 100. It can't go more than that, so out here it's still 100. Let's say this lung disease is causing the PaO2 to drop. So my saturation's 100. With a PaO2 of 500, it drops down to 300. What's my saturation? Drops down to 200. What's my saturation? Okay, now it gets down here to 100. And now my pulse oximeter says 95. Would that upset very many of you? I doubt it. What if it got to 90? Do you think that might start to get your attention? Probably. There's a little fudge factor in there. You never can be quite sure. What's the PaO2 at 90? It's about 60. That animal has horrible, horrible lung disease, which it's been showing for a long time. And I really wasn't aware of it until it dropped down to the point where I started saying, I don't believe that is a good number. So the pulse oximeter is not real good at picking up, you know, lung disease by measuring saturation. Now, if I've been measuring blood gases, and it went from 500 to 300 to 200 to 90, I would have known about this a long time ago. But I'm not going to pick that up with the pulse oximeter. Now, when the curve starts to drop like this, all of a sudden the pulse oximeter becomes a lot more useful. It's very good at detecting life-threatening hypoxia. Now, at this point, when you start to get saturation below 90, that's life-threatening. That's not good. You know, that's a problem. And now I'm going to pick it up with my pulse oximeter. If I go from 90% saturation to 80, that's only about 10 millimeters of mercury change in partial pressure. It becomes much more sensitive there. If you want another little rule of thumb, when the saturation gets to be below 90, if you subtract 30 from the saturation, that tells you approximately what your PaO2 is. So 90 minus 30 is 60. 50 minus 30 is 20. And that's pretty close to, you're lucky if you've got a patient with a 50% saturation that's still alive in there. So it's that rule of thumb works pretty well. Another thing that people believe is that the pulse oximeter is going to be really good at detecting hypoventilation. They say, well, if my patient's not breathing, I'll know it right away from the pulse ox. That's another fallacy. Think about it. You're on 100% oxygen. Now, I don't know if you know this very much, but people have done studies, and if you've got an endotracheal tube in and you're breathing 100% oxygen, your airway is open, you cannot take a breath for hours and you won't get hypoxic. Now, your CO2 will go way up, but you will not get hypoxic. So what happens? You stop breathing, your lungs are full of oxygen, your airway is open, and your PaO2 drops from 500 to 400 to 300 to 200 to 150 until you start to get worried about it somewhere around here. That could be hours. You will not pick up the hypoxia hypoventilation on that patient. They don't have to take a single breath, and you won't see any change on your pulse ox, probably. Now, if you're not using 100% oxygen, they're breathing room air, and they stop breathing, that's a different story. Now, I'm not recommending you do that so that you can pick up hypoventilation, but you're probably a lot more likely to do it because now you're starting out with, you know, an inspired, an arterial PO2 of around 100, and now if I drop down a little bit, because I'm not breathing, it's going to show up on there again. But if you're breathing 100% oxygen, the pulse oximeter is worthless at detecting hypoventilation. Now, when you measure an arterial blood gas sample, what you're doing is you're looking at the amount of oxygen that's being delivered to the tissue. Now, remember, that only tells you part of the story. If I don't know how much hemoglobin there is in my blood, I don't know the whole story. You know, so if I know the hematocrit, if I know the saturation, all these things tell me something about how much blood is being, or how much oxygen is being carried in the blood. So I have to know saturation, I have to know hemoglobin, all those things. Another thing that you may not have thought about is how does the oxygen get delivered to the tissue? It gets delivered in blood that's circulating. Okay? Now, if the blood is circulating very fast, I'm delivering a lot of oxygen. If the blood is flowing very slowly, I'm not going to be delivering as much oxygen. Let me give you an example of that. This is what's going on. Oxygen goes into the trachea, goes down the airways into the alveolus. The alveolus is surrounded by capillaries, and blood flows through those capillaries. And the gas, the oxygen in the alveolus, goes through a membrane into the blood, and CO2 that's in the blood goes through the membrane into the alveolus. And you exhale, you carry the CO2 away. When you inhale, you bring oxygen in. And so blood without much oxygen, 72% saturated, goes into by the alveolus, and when it comes out, it's 97% saturated with oxygen. I've got an oxygen content of 15 mils per deciliter when it goes to the alveolus, and when it comes away from the alveolus, it's got an oxygen content of 20 if I've got normal hematocrit. The next thing it does is it goes through the left atrium, through the left ventricle, through the aorta, and now it goes by the cells. And the cells suck oxygen out of there, and now the venous blood loses 5 mils per deciliter because the cells took it away from there. Now, if I had a big dog, like a 30-kilogram dog, a 66-pound dog, that's about a 1 meter square surface area. And a dog that big just standing around, wagging his tail, looking at you, pumps 4 liters every minute. So two of those big soda bottles every minute. So if you took two of those, you know, bottles and you poured the contents out for 1 minute, that's how fast blood flows out of that dog's aorta. That's quite a bit of blood flow. So that he's delivering 800 mils of oxygen every minute to the tissues. And the cells take away 200 mils every minute. Now, when you go to these receptions and things here in the meeting, and you're in the room and you're hungry, and the waiter comes out and he's got, you know, hors d'oeuvres on his tray, and he walks through the room, everybody runs over and starts grabbing these things off. You can think of that as that's the way blood is delivered. So there are 8 cookies on this tray, representing 800 mils of oxygen. And when it goes by the cells, the people in the room take away 2 cookies. And he goes back in the kitchen, he's got 6 cookies on his tray. He goes back into the kitchen, it's like going there, and they stick some more food on his tray, and he goes back out into the room. And people keep taking it off like that. What happens if he doesn't go through the room so quickly? You guys still want cookies, so he's going like this now. People are still snatching cookies off the tray. Now, because he's going slower, it took longer to get through the room, and now there are only 4 cookies on the tray when he gets through there. Normally, you take 2 cookies out of the 8, 25%. Now, because my cardiac output is reduced, there are only 4 cookies on there. I've extracted half the cookies from the tray, or I've extracted half the oxygen from the blood. And that's about the maximum amount of oxygen you can extract without causing problems. So I've cut my cardiac output in half. And what happens is I have less and less oxygen in the venous blood. Let's say that I've got an anemic patient, and their cardiac output is perfectly normal. But now when the waiter comes out of the room, because the patient's anemic, he's only got 4 cookies on the tray instead of 8. Now the cells still want 2 cookies. So now we've got a very low amount of oxygen in the venous blood again. He's extracted half the oxygen out of the blood because the hematocrit is low. Now I could fix that if I give more blood, I put more cookies on the tray. Cardiac arrest. The waiter comes in the room and he collapses on the floor, and you guys just take all the cookies and keep eating them until they're all gone. So heck with him. You're going to have very, very little oxygen in the blood at that point. The funny thing is, if I take an arterial blood sample, it's going to look fine. The blood that went by the alveolus is full of oxygen. It was ready to be used, and it never was used because the waiter died, you know, and fell to the ground. So when he came out of the kitchen, he still had 8 cookies on his tray. But all the oxygen was extracted from the blood during cardiac arrest. So when you measure an arterial sample, you're measuring the oxygen that is in the blood being delivered to the tissues. And another thing that it depends on is cardiac output. If I measure a venous sample, I can see how well the patient is doing with supplying blood for the needs of that patient. If the venous O2 is very low, it means that I'm extracting a lot of oxygen, and it could be because I'm anemic, or it could be because I have very low cardiac output, or it could be that I'm hypoxic also. So there are 3 things: hypoxia, low hemoglobin, or low cardiac output that would cause that venous sample to be very low. The best place to take a venous sample is actually in the pulmonary artery, but a jugular venous sample is pretty good. A central venous sample is better than that. And if you can do any of those things and you look at that, you may find that that's useful. How many people have capnographs in their practice? So maybe about 25%. That's been going up last 5 years too. Unfortunately, this is the newest bit of technology, so most people are not very familiar with this, and they really are uncomfortable with it. One thing we found when people started to measure blood pressure, they go, "Oh my God, this thing must be broken because all these cats that I'm doing, their blood pressures are 50. Can't be, you know, my patient. It's got to be the equipment." No, you're just never measured it before and didn't realize how bad a job you were doing. Well, the problem with these is when people get these, they hook it up and they go, "Oh crap, this thing's got to be broken. It says the end-tidal CO2 is 60. Can't be my patient." Well, it is. It is. Every single drug that we use for anesthesia is a very potent respiratory depressant. Patients that get anesthetic drugs don't breathe very well. And when you don't breathe very well, you hypoventilate and your CO2 goes up. And that surprises people. They go, "God, I thought everything was fine." Well, is what happens. You know, it's funny. When you don't look at something, it's amazing how little problem you have. But people that don't measure blood pressure don't have any problems because they don't know. And same thing if you're not measuring ventilation in some way, you don't realize how badly patients hypoventilate. Now, to be honest with you, if you're breathing 100% oxygen, healthy animals probably tolerate that hypercapnia, the CO2 being too high, pretty well. The way that CO2 monitor works is pretty cool. What's going on is I've got venous blood, and it's got a PCO2 of about 46. So 46 millimeters of mercury partial pressure of CO2 in the blood. It gets up to the alveolus. It flows by the alveolus. And again, there's a membrane separating the gas from the blood. And CO2 goes from the blood into the alveolus. How much CO2 is there in room air? Nothing. It's like 0.03% or something. Very small amount of CO2. So you can pretty much disregard what's in the air. So the air that goes into the alveolus starts out about zero, and you keep dumping CO2 into the alveolus until the partial pressure in the alveolus is the same as the partial pressure in the blood. And then what you do is you exhale, and the very last gas that comes out of your lung probably comes from an alveolus. The first gas that comes out is going to be the gas that's just went, the last gas that went into the trachea comes right back out, never did anything. That's called anatomic dead space. And there's also dead space from your equipment, and that's called apparatus dead space. So your endotracheal tube is dead space. Your trachea, your bronchi, the bronchioles, every place where gas exchange doesn't take place is anatomic dead space. So you have a meter on the end of your endotracheal tube, and when the patient exhales, the last gas that comes out of there is going to have the highest CO2 in it, and that's the gas from the alveolus. And if it is alveolar gas, the gas in the alveoli and the gas in the blood should be the same. So this is cool. You can non-invasively measure arterial CO2 with this apparatus. Of course, like anything else, you know, there's some potential problems. If you plot out the concentration of CO2 over time, you get the shape, and that's a normal capnogram. The highest CO2 is right before you start to inhale. And the lowest CO2 should be as you start to inhale. That should be, because there's when you inhale, there's no CO2 in the atmosphere. So when you breathe in, the gas that goes by the sensor has no CO2 in it. So it's zero. And it starts to go up when you exhale. And as you exhale, this is the beginning of expiration. It goes from nothing because you were, you know, inhaling. And then you start to exhale. And as soon as gas comes out of the lung, it goes up, peaks at end tidal, and then it drops down again when you inspire. Now, there's one other thing that can happen to your reading of the end tidal CO2. And this is something that people aren't aware of, and you really need to remember this to make good use of this capnograph, is there's something called alveolar dead space. What happens if the blood supply around the alveolus stops? There's no blood flow through there. There's nothing to carry CO2 to that alveolus. And that's something that can happen very easily. If you had a surgeon, he's working in the chest, and he squeezes the pulmonary artery, and all the blood flow through that side of the lung stops, all that whole lung lobe is not going to be able to deliver any CO2 to the alveolus. All dead space. It's called alveolar dead space. Another example of where this could happen is if you have a pulmonary embolus. That will also cause a lot of alveolar dead space. any kind of lung disease can cause alveolar dead space. And this is why it's so critical to understand this. If you've got a patient with lung disease, that end-tidal CO2 may no longer reflect arterial CO2. The bigger the difference between arterial CO2 and end-tidal CO2 indicates the amount of alveolar dead space that you have. Why is that 20 instead of 40? Because that half the alveoli have zero CO2 in them, and the other half have 40. And when they mix together and come out of the patient, you have half as much CO2. Why would that be a problem? Let's say you didn't think about this and you're using your end-tidal CO2 to decide whether you're ventilating adequately. Maybe you see 20 on there and you had the patient on a mechanical ventilator. And you go, oh, wow, I'm ventilating this guy too much. I should back off to 40. Well, you do that now, his arterial is 80. Because you didn't recognize that he has bad blood disease. You didn't bother to take the time to run a blood gas. So now you just trusted this machine and didn't understand the way it worked. And now you've done a disservice to your patient. Or let's say you get 40 for that. And you think, well, I'm doing a great job. It's 40. That's just where I want it. Everything's great. And the CO2 in the artery is 80 again. That's a big problem. This capnograph really works best when you combine it with blood gases. Now, healthy patients usually don't have a lot of alveolar dead space, but sick patients do. Patients that are getting a thoracotomy do. Patients with lung disease do. And so if you just rely on this one monitor without thinking about what's going on with lung disease, you could be really doing a bad job. Now, the blood gas will pick this up. So if you've got the ability to do a blood gas, if you check a blood gas once during the procedure on that sick patient or the thoracotomy patient or the patient with lung disease, maybe you've got a better idea of how to interpret the end-tidal. But don't just rely on the end-tidal alone. Another thing, if I got an end-tidal CO2 of 50, how is that possible? It isn't. Where did that CO2 come from? If the CO2 in the blood is no more than 46 and the arterial is 40, where did that CO2 come from? It couldn't have. It has to be that your machine is not calibrated properly. So if you either your blood gas machine is bad or your end-tidal machine is bad, it's got to be a mistake. So you can never get an end-tidal CO2 higher than arterial. It's just impossible. So if you're getting that, maybe your machine needs to be calibrated. Now here's something interesting. EKG, arterial pressure, and capnogram. Oop, that's not good. So we just suffered a cardiac arrest there. VFib, blood pressure dropped to zero. And look at the capnogram. Each breath has a little bit lower CO2 in it. And after a minute or so, it's dropped to quite a low level, which I'd probably notice and say, that's not right. Why is that happening? Because we had a cardiac arrest, there may be a lot of CO2 in the blood, but remember our delivery system is shut down because of cardiac arrest. So how does that CO2 get to the alveolus? It can't. The conveyor belt's dead. The conveyor belt stopped. There's no way to get CO2 in the alveolus. So what you see when the cardiac arrest occurs is the CO2 dropping lower and lower and lower with each breath. That's assuming you're ventilating the patient. You know, usually when you have a cardiac arrest, you go into respiratory arrest too. But if you were ventilating for that patient or they were on a ventilator, you would see that CO2 drop lower and lower and lower. And that's an indication that you've got a cardiac arrest. Here's another capnogram. And you can see that the CO2 is not dropping down to zero. What sort of things could cause that? If the flutter valve in your patient circuit was stuck open, that could do it. Pardon me? It's unlikely unless there's an equipment problem. It's theoretically possible, but I doubt you'd be able to do that. Another thing that's probably not too likely, but it could happen, is all your soda sorb is exhausted. You could get that also. But the thing is, there shouldn't be any CO2 in the inspired gas, and there is. And usually it's an equipment malfunction. And there are quite a few possibilities for that, but flutter valves would be one. So stuck flutter valve. This is something that I've seen before, is people were getting high inspired CO2s and they were using a Bain circuit or some other type of non-rebreathing system. And what they did was that they had the flow set too low. And in order for the non-rebreathing system to work, you have to have adequate flow. And if you don't, you start to rebreathe gas. So that's another good possibility. We've had the inner tube in a universal F circuit twist or a Bain circuit get detached, and that can cause it, and then exhausted soda sorb. This would be what would occur if your endotracheal tube got disconnected from the sensor, and that happens under the drape sometime. So there are a lot of things you could pick up with the capnograph. Oh, here's a good one. This is actually why they invented these little portable handheld ones, is if you're a EMT and you're out in the field and you stick your endotracheal tube and you want to know whether it's in the trachea or in the esophagus. If you stick it in the esophagus, there's probably some CO2 in there because it's probably some deadbeat that was drunk driving and it's got a lot of gas from beer in their stomach. But other than that, there shouldn't be a lot of CO2 in there. And the other thing is, when you ventilate, if it's in the stomach, it doesn't change in there. And if you're in the trachea, you'll see that nice capnogram in there. So that's why they invented one of the reasons they invented those things is to check on intubation. And you can do that. If you're worried whether you've intubated or not, the best way is to see the tube go into the trachea. But if you hook it up to this, that's also an excellent way of doing it. See if you get CO2 back. We talked about what happens when you have a cardiac arrest. If you have a cardiac arrest and you want to know how you're doing with CPR, the American Heart Association recommends two ways. The best way to do it is one that's a little bit tricky, especially after the fact, is to use direct arterial pressure. So have a catheter in an artery and look at the pulse wave as you do CPR, and that's the best. Second best is to look at end-tidal CO2 and see if that increases. That usually indicates you're doing a good job on CPR. And here's a patient that I actually anesthetized. Systolic blood pressure, mean blood pressure, diastolic blood pressure. I've got great numbers, and all of a sudden things start to go bad. And now they go bad pretty quickly. And when your systolic, diastolic, and mean are all the same, that means you're not no pulses anymore. That's not good, I hear. Well, I had arterial pressure, and I had a capnogram. And you can see as soon as the cardiac arrest occurred, the CO2 dropped. Well, I started doing things there. Now, it actually still had a regular rhythm, but the blood pressure just disappeared for some reason. And I think I gave it some fluids and some epinephrine. And boom, all of a sudden things go back. Look what happened to the CO2. When I started to resuscitate that patient, the CO2 went up. This cat went home and it was perfectly fine. So I had everything lined up to detect the problem, and I knew what to do when it occurred, and I had a way of monitoring the effectiveness of my treatment, and you end up with a patient. You know, you have to have a patient you can fix, but if you have a patient you can fix and you can monitor things correctly, you can end up with a patient that goes home. If you don't know what you're doing, you don't have a way of monitoring things, you miss the cardiac arrest, you end up sending them home in a plastic bag. Let's see. I'm going to skip ahead here a little bit. So, what's wrong with Sadie? What do you notice about Sadie?
She's
The tongue is blue. So what could cause that? It's not getting enough oxygen. So how could I tell? Now we're at the university, and we can do pretty much whatever we want to do on this dog. What would you like to do first if you want to run a test? Take pictures, of course. You got to take pictures. And we can take a picture, get a history from the owner. And the owner had this dog spayed, and they noticed that the color looked kind of crappy. But Sadie's pretty happy, healthy dog, doesn't really have a lot of problems, but she's always kind of this color. Did you have a pulse oximeter on Sadie during the... So what kind of test could I do on Sadie? You said she's not getting enough oxygen. We could run blood gases. The other thing, you know, you might think about, you know, what sort of disease could be causing this. You know, like heart disease could be causing this, right? Can you think of some problems where you would have cyanotic heart disease, like a right-to-left shunting PDA or a VSD with pulmonary hypertension? Those are diseases that could cause that. She certainly doesn't act like she's got lung disease in there. She's pretty active dog. So we run a blood gas, and she's on room air at sea level, and it comes back 100. So what do you think is going on with this dog? Do you want to run any other tests or anything? Pardon me? Okay, we run hematocrit, and it's 45 or 50. Now, what did I tell you the saturation should be at room air? Is that arterial PaO2 of 100, is that normal? Okay, so that's okay. So we're delivering enough oxygen, and the saturation is only, you know, I forget what it is on room air. It's probably... Yes, she said the cup won't fill. This dog has, I've seen it like 3 times. It's a pretty uncommon problem. But the hemoglobin's not normal. And there, I've got enough oxygen available to fill up that molecule, and it's not. So this dog has a problem with a defect in the hemoglobin molecule, and it's kind of got, when we ran... One thing you can't tell with the pulse oximeter is what types of hemoglobin you've got. The kind you're interested in is oxyhemoglobin, but there's all these other types of hemoglobin. You can have carboxyhemoglobin, where you've exposed to carbon monoxide and you've got that cherry red color, and methemoglobinemia, where you know acetaminophen poisoning and things like that. This dog has a problem, and it had a lot of methemoglobin there, because we can actually measure the different types of hemoglobin, and it's caused by a defect in the hemoglobin molecule in there. And so Sadie has no lung problems. She doesn't have any problem with oxygen getting into her lung. Her problem is no heart disease, but she's got a problem with her molecules of hemoglobin are abnormal. So she does pretty well, doesn't have a big problem, but she's kind of this blue color all the time. So, no, it doesn't, you know, it's not great, but it's not. Is her activity very limited, or?
She pants a lot more, even at rest. She'll pant.
But she runs around and plays with
them.
Yeah, I think most of these dogs live a pretty normal life. No, not good. Anyway, thanks for your attention, and